Now a traditional public school that is anything but traditional, classes at this school are organized not by subject, but by project. It was created by teachers, and the idea is to give kids from tough neighborhoods the chance to experiment and the freedom to fail. Kevin McCory of member station WHYY takes us to West Philadelphia and the Workshop School.
The idea started with an innovative project for a few dozen kids at one of Philadelphia's most troubled high schools, West Philly High. The project? Building hybrid cars. In 2010, the students entered an international hybrid building competition and survived the first round. That's when they got the attention of President Obama.
They didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have the best equipment. They certainly didn't have every advantage in life.
The West Philly students rivaled adult projects backed by major corporations and universities.
What they had was a program that challenged them to solve problems and to work together, to learn and build and create. And that's the kind of spirit and ingenuity that we have to foster.
With the program's success, its founding teachers were able to raise private money and convince the cash-strapped Philadelphia School District to let them think bigger. So they founded the Workshop School. This year was its first as a full-fledged public high school. It had 90 students and will grow to 160 kids next year. Hazi Self just graduated from the Workshop School, and he says he loves the fact that the learning there is project-based.
Once you start something, you have to finish it. So, like, any of those life lessons, like, you start something, you gotta finish it.
Unlike traditional high schools, the Workshop School doesn't divide each of its class periods by subject. Although students get traditional math and English in the afternoons, mornings consist of two 90-minute project blocks in which students learn a multitude of skills at once.
It used to be a regular closet, and they gutted everything out, put up walls.
One of teacher Frankie Bonilla's classes turned a classroom closet into a recording studio this year, then learned to compose and produce songs.
Like when we built the studio, there was so much math involved. You know, it wasn't scaffolded. It was kind of like, put this wall up, this is how you do it. They made a lot of mistakes. So it was a lot of English, some science, and a lot of math.
Living in Philly ain't nothing nice. People getting robbed, cops out every night.
Touring the Workshop School, you feel the hubbub of experimentation and collaboration. One ninth grader works on a miniature solar panel. Kanif Parker, a freshman, works on a concept design to make 52nd Street more pedestrian friendly.
We had to make a prototype of what it would look like to make it lighter, like make it for people to come more.
On the ground floor, three large automotive shops where students combined to design and build hybrid cars. Senior Demetrius Kennard stood proudly in front of his handiwork, a blue Model 818 hybrid that runs on fryer oil.
My part in the car was the brake, suspension, and steering components. Take the brakes off the old salvage car and modify it to fit on this 818 car.
For Matthew Riggin, one of the school's founding teachers, what really sets the Workshop School apart is its insistence that kids need to have the freedom to learn from their mistakes.
We give our students a lot of freedom and a lot of responsibility to sort of organize and carry out the work. There's less emphasis on telling everybody exactly what they have to do all the time and more emphasis on them figuring out what that is and understanding what it means to sort of live up to your goals and your values.
Hazi Self says it's working. He's been amazed at the evolution he's seen in his classmates. Many are talking about college for the first time.
It's a big change because they want to go to community. When last year they just say, I'm going to just have a little job. Everybody want to do something with their life now.
He knows the change perhaps better than anyone.
Last year, I wasn't even talking to nobody. Like, I was too mad about a lot of stuff because I didn't have my mom.
Haziz's mom had been arrested and imprisoned, and he had to move to West Philly to live with his dad after years of living in New Jersey.
I still send her cards. I still write her letters and everything. And she knows, she's happy for me because even though it was a big change for me, I still was able to stay on task, go to college like I said I was. So I'm good.
In the fall, Haziz will head to Shippensburg University, and the Workshop School has a green light to expand, reaching 500 students by 2018. For NPR News, I'm Kevin McCory in Philadelphia.
My man still lost his mom at a young age, but they ain't stopping because he knows she in a better place. I feel bad for my man, he ain't deserve that. If anything ever pop, he know I got his back.
During these dog days of summer for most American children, back-to-school season feels a long way off. Though not at one elementary school in North Carolina, which is kicking off its first full week of the new school year. From WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina, Greta Johnson explains why.
The kids are in their first day finest. New shoes, haircuts, there are even a couple of tutus. Parents are dropping off their children and teachers are greeting them as they stream into Hall Fletcher Elementary.
So how many scholars will get out of this car? Hey, Malik, chess champion. Hey, Manny.
Here you go, bud.
In a white suit and bow tie, Principal Gordon Grant welcomes each student by name as they climb out of cars and grab their book bags. These kids are back after 5 weeks of summer vacation. That's about half of what they're used to. There are some sleepy faces, but for the most part, the students seem as excited as they normally are on the first day of school. Hall Fletcher is starting a 3-year experiment with the new year-round calendar. Here's Principal Grant.
Children who don't have really good, enriching opportunities provided for them in the summer move back academically.
Those kids often come from families that can't afford summer camps or vacations. About 80% of the kids here come from low-income families that qualify for free or reduced-price lunch. The kids will get the same amount of school, just distributed differently. There will be 5 weeks of summer break, then 2 3-week breaks in September and March, along with Christmas break. Tamara Owen is the grandmother of 2 Hall Fletcher students, 1 second grader and 1 kindergartner.
My second grader remembered his lunch number today. Last year he couldn't remember it. And I was like, yes, they retain the things that they learned.
Sociology professor Carl Alexander at Johns Hopkins University has studied learning gaps between kids from different economic backgrounds.
Almost all that gap increase happened during the long summer break when all children's learning was dependent on the resources available to them and their families and their communities, with school out of the picture.
A couple years ago, Asheville City Schools tested kids in reading before and after summer breaks. Kelvin Cyrus is the assistant superintendent for the district.
Our numbers broke out the same way. You could tell during this school year, the growth was almost the same, a little bit more for those who were not economically disadvantaged. But that whole summer thing was right here at home.
Only about 3 or 4% of the schools in the United States operate on a year-round schedule, so there isn't much data to show how much of a boost they give kids. Paul Van Hippel has studied year-round education. He's with the University of Texas in Austin.
Students learn more in the summer because they're getting some instruction then, but they're learning less during the school year because they have these extra breaks. And over 12 months, the total amount that students learn doesn't change.
Helping the school transition to the new calendar is Evelina Pierce, an AmeriCorps volunteer. She went door-to-door with Principal Grant to convince families to try the new schedule. She says it helped that many of the parents here used to be Grant's students.
And he has built that relationship with people where they do trust that he is doing things to support them and their children.
But Pierce says she knows of at least 3 families who said they left Hall Fletcher because of the calendar change. This isn't Hall Fletcher's first experiment with year-round school either. Principal Grant says they tried it back in the 90s, but gave up on it.
After 3 years, they dropped it because of the mismatch of the balanced school year calendar with the regular school year calendar. I think we've done a better job of matching those calendars this year.
Cyrus, the assistant superintendent, says even if test scores don't improve, he still likes the idea of a year-round calendar. After all, the one we've got now is based on an agrarian lifestyle that most of us don't live by. For NPR News, I'm Greta Johnson.
Well, here's one way a few nonprofits are trying to eliminate the high unemployment rate among young blacks and Latinos: create a gateway to highly sought-after tech jobs. In Oakland, California, just outside of Silicon Valley, a lot of young people are wondering how they can move from fast food counters, say, to high-tech desk jobs. NPR's Arthi Shahani tagged along with one young woman who's trying to make the leap.
This high-tech story starts at Taco Bell.
Order 209. Come on now. You have a nice day, okay?
Tanika Armstrong makes burrito supremes and sells Coke. She counts pennies and quarters, and she gets orders from her bosses, who can be pretty condescending.
They just be like, oh, did you know that already? Or can you do this? I was like, yes, I've been doing it for almost a year now.
Armstrong lives 2 lives. This first one, which starts as early as 5 a.m., doesn't challenge her or pay well. That's why the 20-year-old set off in search of life number 2.
I'm trying to do an outline of a website.
Armstrong is staring at a laptop in the offices of a small nonprofit called Hack the Hood. Hood because here in Oakland, California, things can get pretty rough, and hack because that's slang for making money in tech. Armstrong is spending her afternoons here this summer. Her job is to fix websites for clients.
There's a lot of other links, like you click on it, take you everywhere in the world. I like short and simple.
This summer, the teens will meet top talent from the companies that make all those apps they download. Armstrong says there is some chance she'll get deep into coding, or she might prefer a non-technical job in the tech sector, like sales and marketing. And that's okay.
Nobody ever asks young people that come from affluent neighborhoods why they're doing programs.
Zakiya Harris is a program instructor.
The more you expose young people to opportunities, the better that they're going to become as adults.
Harris's work with the teens is based on this question.
How can we empower them with some low-hanging fruit skills in the tech industry so they can start earning some money in their pocket that's going to actually lead to a career and not just a dead-end opportunity in a service job?
It's a really big question with a really small budget line. Frida Kaper-Klein is an investor in Silicon Valley and a leading philanthropist for coding nonprofits. She gives a few million dollars a year, and that's rare.
Foundations are giving tens of thousands of dollars for new programs, and in the aggregate, you might be getting hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Google recently gave Hack the Hood $500,000 after it won a competition. The tech company has pledged to give $50 million overall to programs in the U.S. and abroad that try to get women into computer science. Kaper-Klein is talking to Twitter and others, asking them to step up too.
What's going to distinguish tech companies going forward is who takes this seriously and who doesn't.
We were going to small local businesses and asking them if they wanted a website for their business.
Tanika Armstrong was at Hack the Hood last summer too, and she liked the challenge of pitching their services to business owners.
They was like, what's the catch? What's the catch? I was like, no, it's free.
Armstrong says that process can feel weird, but it's better than making burritos. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, Oakland.
The University of Arkansas today released what it calls a first-ever study comparing charter schools to traditional public schools. The study's headline, Charter Schools Keep Pace with Public Schools in Terms of Student Achievement, and they do it with a lot less money. Claudio Sanchez with the NPR Ed team reports that both the study's methodology and its conclusions are controversial.
The study focused on 8th graders in 28 states and is based on two sets of data. First, the amount of money charter schools receive per student compared to public schools. Researchers then compared how kids in both kinds of schools did in reading and math, based on one big test, the federal NAEP test. The study's conclusion, according to the lead author, Patrick Wolf,
the charter school sectors in states across the country are more productive in generating desirable student outcomes at a lower cost than the traditional public schools.
On NAEP, charter student scores are roughly on par with those of traditional public school kids. Wolf, however, argues that charters are 40% more productive because they get less money, about $3,800 less per student on average.
Charter schools have to be very lean. We know that they tend to employ fewer administrators, fewer support personnel. They tend to channel more of their scarce resources directly into the classroom. And so that may be the specific source of their greater productivity.
But one NAEP official told NPR the study's correlation between NAEP scores and school funding is not reliable. And Ted Coldery, who many consider the godfather of the charter school movement, says he's not convinced by the report.
This is the kind of, quote, study we've been seeing for years and years that falls into the category of advocacy research. Pretty soon you'll have another study showing just the opposite.
Another big flaw, says Coldery, is that the researchers' definition of productivity and effectiveness is based exclusively on standardized test scores.
Is achievement, performance, success, quality really one-dimensional?
Some critics also say that the $3,800 funding gap is overstated. The National Education Policy Center has argued that charters often depend on districts to pay for big budget items, like school lunches and transportation. Charters also don't enroll nearly as many special education students who are more expensive to teach. Still, Patrick Wolf stands by his study.
What our research is suggesting is when funds are scarce in education, as they are now, we're getting more bang for our buck with our investments in public charter schools compared to district-run schools.
But in the long-running debate between supporters of charters and traditional public schools, this study raises more questions than it answers. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.